fifth case, and United States versus Martin, where Stacey, you have another opportunity to
have your opportunity to crash and burn.
No.
May it please the court, I represented Mr. Martin in proceedings before the district court and continue as his appointed counsel on appeal. It's a appeal following a trial, jury trial, and conviction for felon in possession of a gun and ammunition. Mr. Martin is 64-ish years old.
Well, I'll help you.
Yes.
I'll help you in your objective of crashing
and
burning.
Thank you, Your Honor.
By asking whether any of the subjects that you and prosecutor have debated in this case have the smallest relevance to the outcome. The subject you're debating appears to be the validity of this warrant, or rather the time limit on this warrant under Indiana law. But why would the exclusionary rule enforce time limits under Indiana law? And my understanding is the exclusionary rule enforces the requirements of the Fourth Amendment. Fourth Amendment says it has to be supported by oath or affirmation and has to particularly describe and so on. There seems to be no doubt that this warrant meets the Fourth Amendment. The only claim is that it does not meet additional requirements that Indiana has added to the Fourth Amendment. So why would this be a subject for the exclusionary rule in federal court?
Thank you for the opportunity, Your Honor. I would say that warrant was a creature of Indiana statute. The right to issue a misdemeanor warrant.
Yeah, fine. Look, we've had that kind of claim before. Let's suppose a state judge who lacks authority to issue arrest warrants issues the warrant, but it contains all the findings required by the Fourth Amendment. But the judge is, say, acting out of his jurisdiction, right? Wrong county issues the warrant. Now, we've had that claim before, and we've said that's an issue of state law. It's unrelated to the Fourth Amendment. That does not lead to exclusion in federal court. Or the arrest is made by a police officer acting outside his jurisdiction. We've had that claim before, and we said that's just a matter of state law. It does not lead to suppression in federal court. Why is this any different?
The Fourth Amendment speaks in terms of warrants. The warrant was created by the Indiana statute.
Right, and there's no doubt that this was a real warrant. It was issued by a neutral magistrate. It meets the Fourth Amendment requirements of specificity and of oath or affirmation.
According to
what you're saying is that there is an additional thing that Indiana has gone beyond the Fourth Amendment by issuing this time limit. That may be admirable, that it's gone beyond the Fourth Amendment to create additional protections. But what I don't understand is why we would, in federal court, use the exclusionary rule to enforce a respect in which the state has gone on beyond the Fourth Amendment. That's my question.
The Fourth Amendment, of course, protects our right to be secure in our homes.
Persons, houses, papers, and effects.
Yeah, exactly. The court's read that before.
Familiar language.
An Indiana state statute creates a warrant that may issue upon somebody's failure to appear in court for a misdemeanor in a town court. It exists only through the act of the Indiana legislature.
Yeah, I understand that. But that would lead us, in the case where the wrong county judge issued the warrant, to come out the other way. We would end up saying no warrant is valid unless it complies with state law, even if it does everything the Fourth Amendment says. But we've rejected that position. Is there any way we can be right in saying that extra state law requirements don't lead to suppression in federal court and still allow the line of argument you're offering here?
Yes. I would argue that warrant exists only under the statute that created it, and it was only valid for 180 days.
But now you're saying any violation of state law vitiates the warrant and therefore leads to suppression in federal court. Could you name me a violation of state law that, on your view, would not lead to suppression in federal court?
Well, no. No.
Well, another way, I mean, I guess the way I had come at this is I asked myself the question, suppose, having thought better of things, Indiana decided to pass a statute saying that these misdemeanor warrants are good for 10 years, which would have meant that the warrant was still good, you know, completely independent of this 1991 prosecutor opinion or anything else. I don't see any constitutional reason why Indiana couldn't do that if it wanted to. And if you begin to follow that line, of course, the Constitution establishes a floor under which states can't go. But your argument has to be that in order to even be a warrant for purposes of the Fourth Amendment, it's got to comply with all of the particular requirements that are above that constitutional floor. And even though that might be a rule that we both find attractive, as Judge Easterbrook points out, I mean, cases like United States against Delaporte, other cases from this court at least, have not taken that path. So that's my issue. Maybe there's some preposterous thing they could say that would be so far out of line that it would almost be a due process violation, but I'm not sure there that you'd be in the world of the exclusionary rule.
The mandate of the legislature was that the sheriff shall return that warrant to the court. The sheriff didn't do it. The warrant wasn't supposed to be there at all. It's difficult to point to any lawful reason that the sheriff walked into that person's house. If the right to be secure against invasion by police authorities at the threshold of a home is to have any meeting, this is precisely the form of a sheriff's violation of his duty that should merit a position of the exclusionary rule.
And, you know, if we get beyond this point, I have to say, on a totality, I mean, there's some complex issues about the good faith exclusion, but this officer really seems to have bent over backwards to try to make sure he was staying within the confines of the law. For all I know, if he had any inkling that this wasn't a good warrant, looks to me like he probably could have gotten a warrant on the new offense. But, I mean, I don't know. We don't have to reach that.
We'll never know, of course.
Right. But he certainly was trying to touch all the bases, and there's every indication that the man was behaving in good faith.
I would say that the case
There's just an absolute rule that says mistake of law can never be good faith, but I'm not, where would that come from?
Well, poor Mr. Wilson, in the case I cited before the court, did I think 48 months in prison for being the first person in America to find out it was illegal to possess a gun while you had a domestic restraining order against him. We all have to comply with the law. I have to. The fact I misinterpreted it or didn't read it or didn't understand it or heard improperly what it meant doesn't excuse me from compliance with
the
law.
That's the direct compliance question. It's not the separate question whether the penalty for failing to comply with it winds up being exclusion of evidence in some other in a criminal trial. It's a separate issue. The court's told
what happened in Arizona versus Evans, of course, was a state court statute, an arrest that took place pursuant to a computer record that reflected a state court statute. Continued in effect when it in fact did not. I would argue it's precisely the same situation. The warrant shouldn't have been there, yet it appeared on a computer record. Under the facts of Arizona versus Evans, the court determined that it was a fault of a court employee who failed to make a phone call, and therefore we weren't punishing police behavior by making an arrest on a state warrant that, in fact, had been recalled. In this case, I would argue there isn't a significant difference in terms of application of the Constitution to this stop. The warrant, indeed, was dead by operation of the law. The reason it appeared on a police computer was not that some court employee or even sheriff's employee failed to make a clerical correction. It is that the sheriff failed in his statutory duty to return that warrant to the court. And that duty took place 2 years before they walked into this man's house. If the court reaches the issue of something that may have happened to purge the primary taint of an unlawful warrantless entry, I would argue that the case on its facts is on all fours with Robles-Torres in terms of nothing could have happened in the few minutes between the illegal entry and obtaining Mrs. Martin's consent that could have attenuated that unlawful entry, and watching the lights parade across the podium, I'll ask to reserve what moments may remain. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Chastain.
30 seconds.
Mr. Hanlon.
Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is James Hanlon. I'm Assistant United States Attorney. I represent the United States in this matter. I'd like to begin by responding to the question raised by Judge Easterbrook concerning the threshold issue of the good faith analysis and whether we even have to get there in this case. I had not analyzed the case in the manner that Judge Easterbrook has gone forth, and my only comment was...
It's a pretty fundamental principle, though, that the exclusionary rule enforces only violations of the Constitution and not violations of state law.
Your Honor, that is true, and the fact remains here that at the suppression hearing litigation, both the defense, the government, and the district court, everybody focused in immediately on the issue of whether the warrant was expired under Indiana state law.
It's a standard problem with legal practice. The defense says something, and then the prosecutor says the opposite, and nobody sits down to figure out whether it's relevant.
The only comment I would add, Your Honor, is that the court can affirm on any basis in the record, and I certainly don't disagree with the analysis that you put forth concerning an alternative basis other than what the parties have argued in the briefs for affirming the judgment of the district court in this case. Another issue raised by Judge Wood here concerns whether Indiana could have made a law that extended these warrants to expire to remain valid for a longer period of time. Certainly, I would agree that is possible. That's not what we had here. Probably the most fundamental point in this case from the government's view.
No, my only point was, if that had been the law in Indiana all along, nobody would have been talking about it, which suggests strongly that the federal constitution isn't implicated by what went on. That's all.
Correct, and I agree with that point raised by Your Honor. I think that the link between both of the issues that the parties did discuss in the briefs, both the application of the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule and the attenuation analysis, is a point that Judge Wood raised, where really, if we step back and look at the case as a whole, we look at the purpose of exclusion under the Fourth Amendment, we look at the attenuation analysis this court has employed, the common thread there is police conduct, or in this case, lack of police misconduct. And as Judge Wood has already articulated, the bottom line is that this officer did everything he could and should conceivably have done to respect the Fourth Amendment in this case.
But you know, on that point, you have authority from the Fifth and the Ninth and the 11th Circuits to the effect that a police officer's good faith mistake of law in the context of a traffic stop still violates the Fourth Amendment. You know, we require everybody else to understand the law properly, and the police have that same duty, and the incentives would get really out of whack if we said people get to bury their head in the sand about what the content of the law is. We may never reach this in this case, but I would simply point out that there is reason to think maybe we want to be careful about what we say about mistake of law.
Your Honor, the response I would have to that point is that distinguishing fact here, which I think is very important, as the government's discussed in its brief, both the principle in the Leon case itself, where the warrant was reviewed by prosecutors before it was presented to the judge, and in the Merritt case, which this court decided, the important point here is that this officer wasn't out in the field simply acting on his own volition, that he expressly relied on legal advice given to him by the prosecutor's office in this jurisdiction.
No, I understand that, although there you walk into another minefield, because there are many areas in which the prosecutor and the police are considered to be, as it were, the state, capital S. You know, in the Brady area, you're not entitled to say, well, we didn't turn over the information because it was in the police files, not our files. You have an obligation to act as a unified group. And in the Arizona against Evans case, it's the court, which is outside the prosecutorial ambit altogether, not the prosecutor, not the police officer. And so the question would be, if we had to reach it, whether in this instance the prosecutor as someone on the side of the police, if you will, ought to be considered the same, or whether it's more like advice of counsel. I mean, I can imagine working through some difficult questions there.
That's correct. That's true. And I acknowledge that analysis, but I would go back to the that on this case here, that there's no evidence that the jurisprudence of this court and the Supreme Court in this area rely heavily on talking about evidence of lawless conduct, either ignoring or subverting the Fourth Amendment as the primary reason to impose the extreme sanction of exclusion, and that on the record in this case here, that there is no evidence of any of those, any conduct of that nature having occurred, and that there is no reason to believe that this officer's or that the conduct of the Clark County Sheriff Department in general would be deterred or changed in any fashion by application of the exclusionary rule here. As far as the second issue that is raised in the briefs, as far as attenuation is concerned, I would simply reiterate that, again, the critical point involved there, again, is looking at police misconduct. The government extensively distinguished this case from the Robles-Ortega case out of this court. I believe that this case is very different, that there is a valid voluntary consent here, and importantly, the district judge made a finding of fact, a credibility determination, that she did not believe the testimony of Mrs. Martin, that she did not give consent, and that credibility finding was well within the district court, and that should not be second-guessed on appeal, and within the framework of that factual finding, that the rest of the district court's attenuation analysis was exactly on point here, was correct.
Mr. Hanlon, what is the underlying charge of check deception? What is that in Indiana?
Your Honor, I believe what that essentially is passing a bad check, not sufficient funds.
Well, there may be a difference there. I mean, if you passed a check that had not sufficient funds, but you didn't forge a check, let's say, that could be check deception charge?
Yes.
Right. Should we have any concern about when, a lot of talk about the good faith here, but any concern about the fact that a warrant for a relatively minor charge, when they're not after this guy for financial crimes, Martin, goes as a speeding ticket. That any concern of whether that failure to get the warrant for what you really are about, that there's some sort of subterfuge or... is there some minimum here of reliance? Let's not talk about the temporal quality here. I'm just talking about how is a warrant a warrant a warrant, I guess. Is that in a good faith setting?
The answer to that question would be yes, on the theory that, as the Supreme Court held in Wren, that subjective intentions don't play any role to this Fourth Amendment analysis. And, in fact, when the case is cited in the government's brief, United States versus Van Driel, we have drug task force officers who went along on the service of a deer poaching violation search warrant when they were really hoping to find evidence of dealing drugs. And I would submit that that's an analogous context here, where this court upheld once again the principle that subjective intentions should not be considered by the court.
Well, we had deer poaching is a pretty serious theft, I suppose. And DEA is looking for some drug offense. Was that the facts in that case?
Yes, Your Honor.
So you'd say that'd be analogous to seeking somebody, a potential bank robber, on an insufficient check charge?
It is not a precise analogy, but I would submit that the principle still stands, that the subjective analysis should not be taken into account by this court. The district court properly applied the good faith exception here. The district court properly found that there was attenuation between any possible illegal conduct and the voluntary consent. If there are not any further questions, the government will rest on the arguments and authorities in its brief and respectfully request that this court affirm the judgment of the district court below. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Allen. That's it. Forty seconds. We'll extend that to a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would address this issue. As I noted in the brief, the Indiana Court of Appeals looked at this issue and did so in 1979. The Indiana Supreme Court held the expired misdemeanor warrant to be void, conferring no authority for the arrest, and they suppressed consequential confession obtained. I wonder, you know, if this case were brought in state court, just through the happenstance that the United States of America prosecuted this case, that now that the police officers have no duty to comply with state law, there's no means of enforcement, that they may walk into people's houses with void arrest warrants without anything to dissuade them from this activity. So far as we know, they're down there in Clark County today, went back and patted themselves on the back for having been vindicated and continued their practice of walking into people's houses. And I refuse to believe that the Fourth Amendment is not thereby implicated when police officers walk into people's homes without legal authority based on some misguided notion as to what their duties were under Indiana state law. And I thank the court for its attention.
Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement. The court will proceed.